Well, hello, dear listener, and welcome to episode 68 of Making It Women in Film, a podcast where I sit down with women working across the film and TV industry to learn their story and hear all about their craft, career, and vigorous resilience. My name is Evita, and I am very excited to bring this week's episode produced by Bonnie and Brian Ellis Films to you. Today, we are talking with Marie-Claire Bowser. Mary has worked in set decoration for over 10 years with credits on titles including Killing Eve, Paddington 2, Maleficent, Bohemian Rhapsody, Mission Impossible Fallout, and many, many more. But in the last year, she's gone a slightly different direction in this industry, and that is by becoming the Screen Sustainability Manager for Scotland. In this episode, Mary tells us about how environmentalism and filmmaking collide and why it is a human rights issue, and what steps need to be taken to improve this. All opinions are her own, and she's not here as a representative of any organizations. If you stick around till the end, you'll also be able to catch Lana and I's thought on the movie The Menu. Enjoy! Welcome to the show! How are you doing tonight?
Thanks so much. I'm doing very well. Ready to finish up the end of the year from busy first year of my first real inverted commas job, or my first normal job of my life. So yeah, excited to have a proper break.
As an introduction, who are you?
Who am I? Good question. So I am from Dundee City in Scotland. Underrepresented, or like, I don't know, I feel like there's not enough light shone on Dundee specifically as a city, and I would like to contribute my existence of people to Dundee specifically. So I am from Dundee, very proud to be Dundonian, and I am currently working as the Screen Sustainability Manager for the Scottish film and TV industry. But I very much have taken a lot of different twists and turns along my way since starting out in the film industry in total. I originally studied at art school in Edinburgh and originally studied in costume design, quickly transitioned into set decoration, and I've been working in props and set decoration in the film industry across the UK for the last 10 years. And long story short, that I'm sure we'll get into later, basically from our department specifically, was aware of the levels of material waste specifically coming out of our department and felt like I wanted to help contribute and do something towards reducing material waste. Further I got into it, the more I realised how many environmental issues there were in the film and TV industry in general. So have ended up in a kind of divergence or tangent from props and set deck specifically into this role nearly a year ago. So it's a very different type of work, as I was joking about at the start. It's the first kind of inverted commas normal job of my life. So it's been a very different workflow and yeah, very different type of work. But there's been a lot that's really interesting, and it's lots of different rewarding aspects to it. But I'm sure we'll go into that into
definitely a bit more detail. So to go back to the very beginning, where does your film journey begin? Were you always into film? I mean, most people are, but what kind of role did filmmaking and just film in general play in your childhood?
For me, I wouldn't say that I have specific childhood memories of film. And I think, I guess my earliest awareness of my interest in film in general was probably in my teenage years. And I have specific memories of sitting in the Odeon cinema at Camperdown with friends and just feeling like it was just a very otherworldly type of format of something. But I don't think at that time I ever had like an idea that I wanted to work in that specifically. I don't remember ever thinking that's the type of work I want to do. It was a bit more organic maybe than that. I loved making things, I loved drawing things. I knew I wanted to do something that was artistic, and I applied. Part of the reason I went to Edinburgh College of Art specifically was at least at that time, I don't know if they still do this now, but their first year was a general first year. So they took you around all of the departments of all the different topics they did at art school. So we did like, you know, jewellery making, intermedia, I think it was called, graphic design, like all these different types of design and creative arts in general. And it was costume, it was a costume design course specifically that I wanted to do at Edinburgh. So that was my first kind of thought of, oh, that's connected to film and TV. Like that film and TV was a kind of place where I might end up doing costume design. But even when I was on the course, I remember we had, for example, an ex-student who'd done the costume course and was coming back to talk about how she'd worked on a film. I think she'd even designed the film, the costumes in the film, and it won a BAFTA. And I remember sitting there, like, I think I was already maybe in second or third year at that time, and just being like, wow, that's nuts. Like, one, it's nuts that she's actually worked on a film, and then two, it's nuts that she's like won a BAFTA. Like, it just still seems, even though I was already studying the topic of what she was then working in, just the idea that it was even minutely possible that I'd end up working on a film or TV production just seemed crazy to me still, and I was already in the stage of studying it. So yeah, I think it was maybe more a curiosity that's led me into that type of work, and it's probably the same curiosity that's taken me on a different tangent again into a different space altogether, rather than specifically thinking right back at the start, like, oh, it's film specifically I want to work in. It was a creative drive originally, and film was the format that I thought was most relevant to the skill set I had. And and I suppose this is something that's probably quite interesting to explore in terms of the difference between the process of working on a film and then the actual product of what a film is, because I think they can be completely different things. Like, your genre can be very different to how the film was made. So yeah, and that relates to sustainability too.
That's interesting. And then so costume design was it, but I know like the beginning of your career was mainly focused on kind of decor within film. What were kind of your starting points there? Like, how did you get into that?
So I originally had, I suppose, a lot of working in film and TV is to do with timing in general. So I'd say that probably of anybody wanting to get into any film role or film or TV role, is a lot to do with your availability at the time of a specific production starting up, or and what needs that they have for the crew that they're going to bring on. And so I'd say that in general about film and TV production, but also how busy the industry is in general. And I think the year that I was still at university when I was first reaching out to productions to even do work experiences, and this was in around 2011, and by coincidence of me kind of wanting to start to explore the film and TV industry, that was also the year, it was around that same time that we started to get a production boom of these major motion pictures into the UK in general. So in Scotland specifically, we had World War Z came to Glasgow, and somehow I'd found out they were going to be coming to Glasgow and emailed everybody through IMDb that I could find contacts for their costume department, and nobody replied to me. And I was like, okay, I'll try art department. I don't really know what they do, but like, I'm interested to see what they do. So emailed everybody from the art department, and I got a couple of nice replies from them. One of them was kind of like, thanks for your email, and like kind of nice friendly reply, but was kind of a bit like, I don't know if we need anybody. And the other one was super proactive and was like, yes, come and join us on Monday for, I think it was 2 days in the graphics department. So it was within set decoration, but specifically working with our graphics team. So I was like, great, like, any experience is good experience. I didn't know much about the industry. So joined the team. It was a pretty amazing experience, actually, because I remember specifically the very first day of coming into that production, where we had taken over, I can't remember now what the cafe is called. There's a cafe just off of George Square, there's a little cafe that the production took over. And yeah, first day of work experience on this production, I imagined, you know, I'm complete bottom of the food chain in relation to this production, and I didn't really expect to kind of be taking up anybody's time except for the folks that I was going to be working directly with. And as soon as I came in, there was a guy sitting at one of the tables with this kind of what's it called, like the train is it baker boy hats or something, I'm at flat cap, and he was sitting there and he was just really curious in who I was and like what I was doing. And I said I'm work experience, and he basically like sat me down and he was like, look, like, and was showing me all these like visualizations of like how they were going to be transforming George Square into Philadelphia, and all the CGI, like the kind of visualizations for the CGI they were going to be putting in. And I was like, who is this guy? And it turned out he was the designer of the film, Nigel Phelps. And it was just great. It was just a great experience that I didn't expect to have, especially on my kind of first day of work experience. But yeah, it was a great first introduction to the film process. And as well, the graphics team I worked with were great, loads of fun. And the 2 days that I think I was brought in originally turned into, I think it was at least a week, if not two. And through that process, so I was basically working with graphics, but we were doing like set dressing. So they'd already created the graphics, and then we were putting them up around, because we're basically covering like all signage in Glasgow George Square to be like America, so Philadelphia. And so it was a lot of set, it was effectively set dressing, but through the graphics team. And it was through that I actually learned about what set deck was. So to even learn that there was a whole team of people that were, their whole jobs were just sourcing props and decorating sets, I was like, that's nuts. And like, I want to do that. And so Nigel was, just a really chatty guy and very friendly. And he had said at that time, as his advice when I was starting out, he said, once you know what you want to do, like stick at it, like don't jump between departments. Because I explained I was studying costume design at the time. So basically took his advice. And from that experience, the art director who had brought me onto that job, she'd coincidentally worked with the set decorator who was just about to come up to Scotland on their next production. It was Rebecca Alloway. And Rebecca brought me on to Cloud Atlas that same summer. And then from working with Rebecca on Cloud Atlas, I then went, the next time I was in London, I then ended up working on some other projects with her. So it very quickly expanded into other opportunities. And that's a lot to do with the process of the timing of and chance of your availability and in relation to these projects, and the chance of meeting specific people who are looking for to crew on production. So yeah, it was in some ways very organic.
And now you've worked on some really, really amazing productions. Do you have any favorites, whether that's as a project that you admire or your experience working on it?
So I would say that there's lots of different things that you can take from any productions. I think whenever I was offered a job, I would always weigh up different components about it. So 1, what your script is, 2, who you're working with, 3, what your rate is, 4, what your job role is, and then 5, what the location is. So I'd say in terms of favourite actual jobs, I would say when I was looking back at my CV, there's quite a few that jump out, but for different reasons. So I worked on Maleficent and Pan, which I believe the second one of which I haven't actually seen. My friend who I worked on it with was like, don't watch it. It was an amazing experience to work on, but it's a terrible film, so don't watch the film. So I've actually never seen the film. Maleficent I have seen, but both of them, and this is what I was mentioning earlier, where the process of working on something can be very different to what you're actually creating. So that's in some ways the great thing. If you're on a job that you love, in some ways it's irrelevant what the product is, because it's like, well, you had a great experience. That's an example of that, because Pan specifically was, we were doing prop making. So we were making little pom-pom decorations, and on Maleficent I was helping to decorate her treehouse for when she's, it's for when she's like younger Maleficent, and she's got this like kind of treehouse nest, and we were making little kind of like fairy elfin creature things like she would have made out of like pine cones and all these natural foraged materials. So both experiences of like the things we were making in the prop making process was amazing, but then you're equally also within that full decorated environment. So we were in this like magical treehouse for Maleficent and hanging up all these like bits and pieces like trinkets in her little treehouse nest, and then Pan were like literally like running around the set of Neverland when there's like nobody else there and with like trampolines and everything, and it's like that was just like an amazing experience to be in that set. So I have very fond memories of both of those two productions. I would say I worked on A United Kingdom, which was about an interracial relationship with what is now somebody who was in line for the throne to the country that is now Botswana. So I think looking back, that's probably the most meaningful project I've been involved with in terms of what the actual output of the product was. I worked on Paddington 2, which was loads of fun, and it was probably the cutest film I've ever worked on. One of my tasks was to source Paddington Bear, effectively a Paddington Bear stunt double from Hamleys in London, and it was, it had to be like the, because Paddington's CGI, they needed like a real physical version of him on set for when they were when they were speaking to him and when they were pretending. And I think they needed him for, it was like to scan, because I had to, one of the tasks, I had to source his scuba diving outfit. So they needed a real bear to scan so that then they could also put his scuba diving outfit on him or something like this. So
what an amazing job.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's also like, it's that thing where it's like you're tasked with a specific thing and you're at work and you're like, okay, I need to go and buy Paddington Bear and his scuba diving outfit, and that's like a perfectly normal thing to do because that's my job. And then when you're in these actual shops and you're like explaining to somebody what, or you realize, you start explaining to somebody what it is you're doing, and they're just like, is she nuts? Like, what is she talking about? So that can be quite funny as well, because it's, or sometimes I used to find in shops that I would have a very specific list of whatever the thing was I was getting, or 20 reels of whatever specific thing, and I would almost feel this like gravitation of like other shoppers like coming closer like to me, or like looking at what I'm like buying or looking at, just because they were like, I was just shopping with such kind of like determination, and I honestly half the time wanted to be like, you don't need this stuff, like I'm only buying this because I'm working on this film, or like whatever it was. But anyway, so yeah, Paddington was like super, very very cute film, and it was just like it was the reshoots of Paddington, but it was just a really nice vibe again, like a really fun set decorator that I was working for, and just a really nice team. So yeah, so there tends to be like different aspects of projects, and you might, I think in general, you, if you can get three out of those five of things that you value in any production you would want to work on, I think that's a pretty solid start. You're probably unlikely to get all five. Maybe you might do, yeah, for different reasons. I've got different kind of favorite films, and like I was saying, it's not always about what is the end product and what is the final thing that we created. It could be complete rubbish that you make. The product could be complete rubbish, but actually the process of being part of it, and some of the best and most enjoyable experiences I had in film were actually on productions that weren't that great, or in the final, or at least not my genre of film to watch. I think that can be two different things.
Yeah, no, that is very interesting, you know, because I think it's quite easy when you're watching a movie to forget. I mean, you don't know the experiences of people who worked on set, unless some of the actors speak out, but you know, then that's also a very limited section of the production and things like that. So it's good to hear, though. I also think for something that isn't like set decoration brings so much depth into this visual storytelling of cinema. Like, it is essential to it. But it's not, you know, the key driver for the storytelling. And so you can still have really well-made production design and then a mediocre story. You know, like, both things are possible, and I don't think that the overall story should disqualify the hard work that went into the production design and things like that. Then you focus on set decor. You know, you set your mind to something. And then they did kind of change direction a little bit. When we've talked previously, you told me about the waste that you were seeing behind the scenes. Can you tell me a little bit more about kind of your realization of the issue in terms of sustainability in film?
Yeah, so I mentioned that I started working in film in technically in 2011. So this was when I was still studying my undergraduate. But from those first experiences, in particular working on massive budget productions, I was very quickly aware of the levels of waste specifically. So that was particularly from set decoration departments, art departments in general. And I think for me, I'm from a very make, do, and mend family in general. We had, I think, 7 recycling bins in our family house. So for me to even come on to productions and recycling, normal recycling, not being something that was just like standard, was quite a surprise. But also, I think more to the point, I was seeing the levels of waste of everyday items. So, you know, huge amounts of money getting spent on props that could be contemporary items like bags or folders, or it could be furniture, tables, chairs, kitchen items that are, you know, for the most part, there's not specific routes of redistribution afterwards. I would say that I'm very aware, even within the UK, of kind of relative poverty. Like, I'm from Dundee, I'm very proud to be from Dundee. But I was also, because I went to a normal state school in Dundee, I was also very, very aware of relative poverty within the UK. And for me, going on to these massive budget productions and seeing things that are actually really valuable to you know, normal people get put in the bin, it just blew my mind. So for me, it was actually, there's kind of this like commentary within the sustainability world of the issue of waste as being something that shouldn't be prioritized, which I do think there is an argument within the picture of like, we need to be looking at energy sources and travel and generator use. 100%, that is something that needs to be reduced. But for me, the issue of waste is less about the actual emissions generated from a specific production, but more, why are you putting normal items that can be directly put into reuse for other people in the UK? And that for me is more of like a kind of human rights issue and a need to create a circular economy, so that actually where there's a problem being generated in one space, which is film and TV needing to get rid of things as quickly as possible when they come to the end of a production, connecting that to people and communities who can make use of those things, because there's especially within the context these days of cost of living crisis, especially, I just think we shouldn't be throwing anything in the bin that has a direct opportunity to be reused elsewhere. So that was the catalyst for me for getting into sustainability in general. And I came into contact through workshop at Edinburgh University with Ben Twist, who's the director of Creative Carbon Scotland, and they work across the creative arts in Scotland in general. And was, you know, said to him, what do you know of what's happening in the screen industry, because it doesn't seem like that much is. Albert had just started, so I don't know if you know much about Albert yourself, but they're the kind of main screen industry organization for sustainability in the UK in general. But they were very, I think 2011 was their first year in general, and it was just one guy for the whole of the country, so it was very early days for them in general. And obviously what they were covering then was much smaller than what they are now. Yeah, so met Ben and had, yeah, from 2011 was, Ben had put me forward to do a master's in environmental management. So when I finished my undergraduate in costume design, I got a scholarship to do this degree and did the study part-time and stayed within industry. So for 10 years I was working, well, for 3 years I was studying the master's degree and continued working in industry. So the total span of 10 years, including the degree. And then when I finished the degree, Ben invited me to write a report with him for Screen Scotland, that was about how the Scottish sector specifically could decarbonise and become less wasteful. So that got published. So we wrote it over 2019 and 2020. And then in 2021, last year, which now seems like a long time ago, it was published. And it sounds super corrupt because I've ended up in the role. But one of the things that we said in the report was that Scotland should have somebody that was specifically looking at our own sector and building on what Albert had started. But we knew that it, you know, the solutions for sustainability need to be very localized. So we needed to help them to flesh out their own suppliers list, for example, which is one of the things I started in when I came into the role, first of all. Yeah, looking at our supply chain in general so that it wasn't just kind of London-centric approaches to things when actually our culture and our sector in general in Scotland is quite different. Like something, it can't be a one-size-fits-all for any of these things. So we knew we needed somebody specifically in Scotland and also somebody that was public sector. And I think that's another area or another aspect of sustainability is the different leverages of different types of stakeholders. So Albert is technically funded by industry, so there will be things that they aren't allowed to say or won't be able to implement where actually public sector need to, because yeah, there are different roles and different responsibilities. So but yeah.
Mm-hmm. So take me through this Creative Carbon Scotland. Take me through the report. So what was it you were doing to get the report? What was your findings? What was the process of gathering all the information?
So it was very much done by consultation with sector. So we interviewed a whole host of different stakeholders from practitioners in the industry itself. And we spoke to suppliers as well. So the key stakeholders who are renting equipment to productions. And we were trying to identify what were the main barriers to sustainable production in Scotland in general. And then we've wrote, I mean, I think it's like a 60-page document. So if anyone's got a bit of spare time to read it, they're very welcome to. But it's quite thorough. It's got, we were looking at training, infrastructure, and the landscape of sustainability within Scotland, and also looking at where was Scotland sitting within the international landscape of sustainability and screen. So we were... The inspiration for my role, for example, came from the Flanders film industry. So Flanders Film Fund, and it's a guy, Tim Wagendorp, very inspiring, funny guy, if anybody ever meets him or has the opportunity to meet him. And it was his role specifically that was already in place over there that we took a lot of inspiration from for the type of work that the role that we identified there was a need for in Scotland would have. So yeah, taking a lot of inspiration from best practice in other places around the world, but also acknowledging actually with any of the work that was happening, that in the industry in the UK and across the world was still in its infancy for really tackling sustainability. Yeah, so it was very much a kind of call to action of saying we need to be part of the solution, and that again the public sector has a role to play in that, to build on what's already been started, but to help take things forward in different places and spaces that perhaps the work hadn't already been done yet. So yeah, I think the general feeling from the report from the stakeholders we spoke to was to that point in time, which was 2019-2020, that a lot of the sector in Scotland, and I think from my experience this is quite unanimous of the industry in the UK in general, was that sustainability engagement with sustainability was very much like a box ticket exercise. It was often something that was put in place as a kind of barrier to funding. So it was kind of like folk were feeling like they needed to engage with it in order to get funding to make their productions made in the first place. And I think there's two main barriers that we identified with that in terms of engagement that I think I feel like what we did two sector to the industry in the UK in general was kind of turn to them and say like, you should be green, like go be green, but like without actually putting in like robust kind of tools and resources of like, or how, like the actual explanation of like, what does that actually mean? And a really thorough understanding of, if I'm working in a props and, or set decorator role, what does that actually mean for me to be sustainable within my day-to-day working practices? And I think there is still work to be done and really kind of dissecting the production process in each of the different departments, because they're all different ways of working, as well as looking at the process holistically to say, okay, because there's so many different, I think there's no one single silver bullet for anything to do with sustainability in screen or in any industry. But within the screen sector specifically, there's also so many different points of intervention, and it does need literally everybody from all different levels of production to get involved to help bring about the change. You can't do it top down only. You need to have people equipped and engaged on the ground, but equally the folk on the ground can't do it without the buy-in from the people at the top. So we knew we needed a kind of more hand-holding available, and not just kind of leaving it to productions to figure it out on their own accord. Because actually what I've learned from this job specifically, the more I go into spaces that are government and city council and all these places that have jobs that, you know, I didn't really expect to be mingling with in, you know, starting out as a in design and creative arts, like these very different types of roles, but also roles that I always assumed were the kind of jobs that, you know, they know what they're doing because they write policy or they write legislation or maybe even like a concern like, oh, the government knows everything about what we're all doing. And it's like, no, they don't. They don't know. And in relation to sustainability, a lot of the people at the top don't know. And I think that's actually something that's, I don't feel like that's an intentional criticism of those people. I think that is part of, there needs to be an acknowledgement of that in the process to net zero, or whatever you want to call it, becoming sustainable, because actually every single sector is learning how can we decarbonize as quickly as we need to, and how can we be sustainable when it covers so many different aspects and there's so much learning and things are changing so quickly. So I think there needs to be a kind of radical honesty of that to say, you know, it's not something, I think sustainability should never be anybody preaching to anybody else to say this is what you have to do. I think it has to be something that's that brings people in and actually listens, like actively listens to people as well. Like, what are legitimate barriers to the supply chain of either in the tech itself or rental companies or from the production side of hiring these products in the first place? So actually figuring out where are the legitimate barriers and, yeah, figuring out are there ways to reduce those barriers or take them away completely. So and cross kind of cross-pollination of ideas, but also sharing of information of that communication to try to get something, the system changed basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I know you said that obviously it varies depending on each different department and each production and things like that, but if we look at the Scottish film industry overall, what are the biggest barriers, what are the key issues, and where's the disconnect
from the Scottish screen sector specifically? Mm-hmm. So I would say that the biggest barrier to the screen sector, I mean, I think there's no single one barrier, but I would say that on the ground, there's still a gap in training. So we need to have department specific, my perspective is I think that there still needs to be department-specific sustainability training that's UK-wide for efficiency, apart from anything else. There's also a gap in, there's been a massive gap in education and training for the role of a sustainability coordinator in the film industry. So this is something that London's had this role for probably about 7 years. we, as far as I'm aware, we've only just started to get these roles onto productions in Scotland this year. And I think that's mostly because the role tends to exist on, or historically has tended to exist on, the major motion picture productions. So they tend to be based down south. We often get them in Scotland, but mostly for location filming. So they might come up with a production, but the role has existed in London for last 7 years or something. And when I was realizing, since I've come into this job, oh, we're starting to get them in Scotland, it was a bit too, my thoughts were two pronged. Like, one, that's great and really exciting, and we need to start encouraging productions to have these roles, because you really, even like a role like mine is very much looking at things holistically and trying to help change the systems that exist around the film production process. But, and that will help to, I'm trying to take the kind of research element or the kind of continued work that productions aren't tasked with doing or don't have the capacity to do on any like one specific project. I'm trying to take that work off of them so that the existing infrastructure around them makes it as easy as possible for them to be sustainable, because whatever could be set up is already set up for them. But even with that role and that type of thinking and that type of work, you still need somebody on the ground on any one specific production looking at, okay, what is our specific production's energy use or plans for energy use, and what is our expected procurement policy, etc, etc. So you need to have both. But what, so on one hand I was like, great, that's so exciting that we're starting to get these in Scotland, but at the same time it's like, okay, one, this role's never existed in Scotland, so we're going to have a skills gap of people in Scotland specifically. But also two, I ended up driving a consultation with Sector, and this was with, I've got counterparts now in Wales, London and Northern Ireland. So we together brought in people who were in these sustainability coordinator roles from across the UK and had a consultation with them to say, what type of training did you guys do to come into your roles? And for the most part, people were kind of mixed backgrounds. Either they come from the sector, and I just kind of learned on the job the sustainability aspects, or they'd come from specific environmental kind of education or sustainability education in some form, and then they'd had to kind of baptism of fire figure out what the heck was going on in the film industry in terms of how we work, which is a very different way of working the film production process. It was very quickly aware in that consultation, okay, there is no current existing sustainability coordinator training in the UK at all for that specific kind of role. So that's been a major gap. Since that consultation in July, I have since found some that exists outside of the UK. And we, through a German environmental consultant who lives in Portugal, so she's delivering online training to the Scottish sector in January. And as far as I know, that's the first of its kind through public sector role in the UK. Yeah, so that's training that we're helping to bring in from outside of the UK, but there is still a gap of that training, being developed within the UK, and us having our own, hopefully, a uniform approach to that type of training across the UK. But as well, like, we're trying to get commissioned just now a research piece into what a sustainability department on a production could look like. So for instance, like, you need your entry level people who are going in and doing the kind of legwork on the ground, but you also need your coordinator role who's looking at things holistically and doing more planning. You also need your head of department role who's going to go into the budget meetings right at the start and say, we need X amount of money for the green budget or the sustainability budget. So we do need all, like, we know that we need different levels of sustainability roles on productions, but there isn't any kind of uniform approach within the UK of either what those job descriptions, what those job titles are, or what the job descriptions are. And that we need that research or that kind of formalization of what the sector thinks it needs in relation to those to then be able to say to productions of, so for instance, working in the space of film funding, if we were then going to say, okay, if you're receiving X amount of money from Scottish Government, you should have on it by ratio a sustainability coordinator or sustainability coordinator plus entry-level person or whatever the format is in relation to different job roles. So that's been a major gap across the UK. And actually, I know that there's these roles have existed in Germany. I think there's two great courses at Stuttgart and Munich. But again, I think that the kind of industry understanding of like what those roles are is still quite new. So it's something that it seems like is quite early days across like international sectors as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And what kind of industry responses have you had? I was going to ask if you've faced resistance, but I do think most people want to appear eco-friendly. And as you said, kind of tick that box at least. But as you kind of started working with this and actually implementing it, you know, reaching out, what were the responses from productions, filmmakers?
I think that, I mean, I suppose in terms of direct on the ground resistance, it's the people who are working on the ground that are most going to experience that directly. So when you've got a sustainability coordinator directly on a production that's is working with construction and trying to suggest that they use a different material or whatever it is, whatever the challenges in any department. So I think in terms of a production facing resistance, that they're the roles that are going to face that most directly. And then my role, I see to be supporting when we have those roles in place. And for the two that have come through this year, I've worked with them to give them, for instance, Scottish specific suppliers lists, but also having that iterative process where I'm hearing from them what's working, what's not on the ground, and how can we further support them within that kind of wider systems approach. So in terms of the production process, they're going to experience that more directly in those roles. But I would say in my role, the biggest kind of resistance or challenge that I've noticed in a year, I mean, for the most part, my job is in place to help make things easier for people. And I think for the most part, I actually haven't experienced that much resistance because I'm helping to solve, or hopefully helping to solve problems for people. But the only spaces where I've seen it happen is one with supply chain, and that's at the bottleneck of rental companies who are that. So the solutions to decarbonizing from our existing technology are already, like, we've already got the solutions, they exist already, but those technologies need to be invested in the capacity of being able to be hired for screen production. Yeah, the people who are in those, basically the small SME businesses in the rental companies, they're having to know exactly what they should be investing in. So there are legitimate, they have concerns about knowing what technology to invest in, and also potentially having the capital expenditure to invest in these technologies too. So this is partly freshly out of a workshop we did last week on portable renewable power in Scotland, and that was specifically around generators. But I think actually for me, hearing those voices and that feedback was actually reassurance to me. Okay, we have a cross-section of stakeholders in this room talking about this subject, and it's actually really good to hear about what those legitimate barriers are, because otherwise we're just creating talking shops of people who think the same way and not actually engaging with where there's spaces where people have, I think for the most part, in terms of people's want or appetite to decarbonize, I'd say that probably about 80, 90, 95% of people want to decarbonize and don't want the world to continue to be in a climate crisis. I think the intention is there, but people have legitimate concerns, like if their business is already set up to supply diesel generators to the film and TV industry, they're like, crap, I've already invested all this money in this technology that's soon going to be not relevant or not used by the industry. So I think there is, and this is part of the bigger picture, Scotland in particular, and Wales is as well, very much driving forward the just transition. So making sure that where we're creating new jobs and new technology, that actually we're not inadvertently putting people out of work, but we're giving them a transition into the new technology. So I think, but there needs to be a conversation that happens that's like, where is the likelihood of that happening? Are there legitimate concerns? What are those legitimate concerns? So in that specifically around the conversation that's been happening on generators specifically in Scotland, and there is a need for there to be further consultation with sector to get really into the weeds of, okay, what are the legitimate concerns? Where is their support? And some of that isn't my direct responsibility to resolve, but it's about hearing that information from our sector, getting that feedback from sector, and then trying to put that into the right spaces of, okay, who is in Scotland helping to coordinate the tech, the development of tech to a low carbon in any industry that uses generators or whatever the relevant technology is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And so despite, you know, resistance, challenges, I'm assuming this is quite rewarding as well, to see things actually moving forward. What would you say is your main motivation to keep on doing this job?
I am an incredibly curious person. Like, I think I kind of, it's funny because when we wrote the report, and I joked earlier about it sounds super corrupt because we wrote the recommendation for the role to exist, and then I've ended up in this role. And actually, to be completely honest, I'm a designer by trade. My passion is in design. I love creating things. I love making things. And ultimately, yeah, that's kind of what I want to do. And I didn't intend, I did my master's in sustainability, and I thought maybe at some point I will end up working in this in the future. But I still thought, and maybe that's partly also to do with when I did that, when I started that in 2014, the climate crisis still felt like something that was maybe going to happen when I was in my 50s or something. And then even within the last 5 years of just being like, oh crap, there's already conversations about how do we adapt to climate change. It's not just about how do we reduce our impact. So yeah, so what I was going to say with when we first wrote the role, it was very much like I'm inputting what my perspective and understanding of this situation is of our sector at this moment in time. But it wasn't, I didn't expect to, and it's not something I was looking to do. I didn't intend to go into that role. And I think what actually was the turning point for me, even when they wrote the job description, I was sending it to other people. And then I had a call with what's now my colleague at Beck2 Vision. And I suppose it was partly to do with, I think I was kind of, it's a very different way of working in inverted commas, a normal job. So I was kind of worried about getting put into a position where I felt like I couldn't be honest about what I thought was actually needed. And maybe it was going to have to be quite a box tick type of role. And maybe it was just a bit like, I don't know, pushing paper around and like having closed door conversations with a bunch of people who already agree with you. So I kind of, it wasn't something I was actively seeking, but when I had the conversation with the organisation who I now work for, it just sounded very supportive of the outlook I had and what I felt like was needed for the sector. And I suppose feeling like I could actually put into action solutions that I thought were needed from the sector, I thought that's, you know, it's kind of exciting to be able to actually help to bring about change. And I suppose it's also been just sheer curiosity in terms of like, how do you bring about change in society? Like I was talking about government and all these people and kind of what I saw to be these high up, high level positions. And it's like, I just didn't even consider kind of, I don't know, I just didn't really know much about kind of how does the world work? How does Dundee City work? How does how does change happen in Scotland in general? And I'm ending up in all these spaces where I'm like, wow, I just find it completely fascinating. And because sustainability is something that for all aspects of society, all sectors need to change, and it's something that's completely new and needing to happen at such speed, it was, I suppose it was also maybe kind of a thinking of like, well, what do I have to lose if I can do as much as I can to help bring about change? You know, maybe there is something quite refreshing about putting people into these roles that aren't the status quo and aren't the norm, because actually the status quo and the norm is the system that we're trying to change. So I think for me, it's feeling like I could bring that kind of fresh air or like a new way of thinking, hopefully, to these spaces was for me quite exciting. And I have, even though it's not specifically a directly creative role, there is a lot of creativity in helping to problem solve, basically. And yeah, my just sheer curiosity of finding out all these different things. I've never been to a car show before in my life. I never thought I'd ever end up in a car show. And then this year was at like electric car conference thing. And it was, I don't know, I just kind of, I find it very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the most important part, is to actually care about it. So as you're saying, one of the big issues is lack of education. I was talking with some of my friends who've been in film school or who've studied film, and generally, unless it's very hands-on set, there's barely any mention of sustainability in screen. It's just not part of, especially in the early years, it's just not part of the conversation. Now, I asked some of our followers for questions here, and we did get some in, but I'll go with the first one. This person said, is greenwashing common in the industry? How can I know if a production is actually, in capital letters, eco-friendly?
It's a really good question, and I suppose it depends. Again, like, sustainability is such a range of different aspects. So you have, as a kind of your main topics of sustainability, you've got energy and power, waste, biodiversity, infrastructure, and then the content of whatever your production is too. Again, I've mentioned it a couple of times, like the process of something can be completely different from the product. So I think it's kind of a hard question to answer directly. There's productions that have sustainable certification, but the actual content of the production that they're showing isn't showing a sustainable way of life or, you know, sustainable ethos or whatever. So it's like, is that production sustainable just because the processes were done in a certain way? And also, what quantifies as being sustainable, because there's so many different aspects. And it's also not just about, I think for me, actually, when you were asking earlier about challenges, one of the biggest challenges I find in the space of sustainability in general is actually people trying to separate the human experience from the environmental experience or the environmental justice aspect. And I actually think it's pretty much impossible to separate those things. I don't think you can only deal with environmental issues in isolation. And actually, I think we'd be lying if we did, because the actual natural environment is going to exist beyond us. It's whether we as humans will become defunct, extinct, because we've depleted the resources that will enable us to keep living in the future. So ultimately, it is a human rights issue. So in the process of decarbonizing production, if you have, you know, if there's an ethos on set that's actually overworking crew and is incredibly sexist or is racist or is any of these isms to do with human rights, that actually I would say that production is not a sustainable production, because it's actually trying to save the planet for a select few number of people in the future. And to me, that's not sustainability. So I think you have to look at it through a holistic lens of taking everybody with you and making things, trying to make the health and happiness of as many people as possible, as good as possible for as many people as possible in the process of trying to decarbonize. And I think for me, that's also partly why my role is hosted through Bechtu Vision, which is a branch of our creative trade union Bechtu. And it's for me, it's all about a kind of grassroots approach to top-down strategy, which is driven by the workers' rights, basically. Yeah, so I think I honestly can't answer that question in any kind of direct way to say, like, I mean, how did they actually frame it about greenwashing?
Is greenwashing common in the industry? How can I know if a production is actually eco-friendly?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any production that's ever been made that is completely sustainable. I think the most sustainable production is no production, ultimately. I think it is quite a difficult question to answer categorically, but I think that when you're looking at sustainability is also the combination of economic, social, and environmental, and you can't take any one of those things out, but also no one single aspect should be completely dominant to the other. So it's, yeah, they have to be looked at altogether because, yeah, it's complex.
It intersects. Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. But I guess that also kind of answers the next question, which was, but can movies ever really be 100% sustainable?
No. Probably not. I don't think they can. I guess what I was going off on a tangent on to say, I mean, again, with this, the context of this podcast being about feminism is that something I had to accept a couple of years ago was like, well, one, that sexism exists. Definitely didn't find that out a couple of years ago. That was more entry level into film and TV industry. But one thing that I did accept a couple of years ago was like, I am never going to see the end of sexism within my lifetime. But despite that, I'm still going to live as fulfilled a life and as happy a life as I possibly can. So I think it would be arrogant or ignorant for anybody to say, we're going to solve the climate crisis. It's like, no, we're already in the climate crisis. The climate crisis is already here. We're trying to make things as less bad as possible for as many people as possible, and for me, like, I want to empower and inspire all those cross sections of people who have been marginalized over the last hundreds of years, thousands of years, possibly women, LGBTQ, ethnic minority groups, and people of different disabilities, because actually these are also the groups who are going to be most severely disadvantaged by the impacts of climate crisis. So we need to empower those communities and help them be part of the solution in making things as sustainable as possible. But yeah, to answer your question, can any one production be 100% sustainable? No, ultimately I don't think they can be completely sustainable.
Moving on to kind of our roundup, I just, you know, I think working in movies, a great way to get to know a person is to know what kinds of movies they watch and shows that matter to them. So I've got a couple questions here. First of all, I'd like to hear about a movie or a show that's inspired you, whether that's creatively or within sustainability.
So I have to admit, there's kind of an irony that since I've been working in film and TV for the last 10 years, I've actually watched more film and TV in the last nearly year that I've been in this new job, because I have more time to actually watch film and TV because I'm not working in it. So actually all my references of inspiring shows are things that I've seen within this last year. So there's quite a few on Netflix. There's one I was watching again to the conversation around gender and gender equality. There's one I watched actually this week called Beyond Men and Masculinity. It's on Netflix. I also loved Russian Doll. It's a drama on Netflix as well. I think the central character to that is just amazing. And also another Netflix show. I feel like I'm getting paid by Netflix to say all this stuff. I'm totally not. And I don't.
Corruption exactly. Strikes again.
I'm not, but another show that they've got that I loved was, there's a program called The Principles of Pleasure, And we didn't end up touching on this in this talk. And again, there's so many different aspects of sustainability. You could spend an hour speaking about any one, but I would say one thing about screen content and gender in particular that I've noticed is how much female sexual pleasure is not represented well in mainstream media at all. And Principles of Pleasure, there's another one by Netflix as well, Love, Sex and Goop, which really I thought were really great examples of female sexual pleasure that actually needs to be put into mainstream media more. And one of the things that I think should be within kind of TV drama or any type of sexual references for women in screen in general should be normalizing that experience, so that it's not actually just about male sexual pleasure, and that we actually, women, can have a accurate understanding of what their own bodies can do that I think has been massively marginalized and not represented on screen. So that's another good Netflix documentary that people should watch. And there needs to be more of that type of show in general.
Excellent, excellent. And I 100% agree. What's your guilty pleasure?
I would say, so again, with watching film and TV in this past year, I got completely binge watch of all of the earlier Kardashians. I think I maybe seen like an episode or two before coming into... this past year. Once I started watching it within this year, I think I've watched all 10 series that are also on Netflix. You can tell I've got a Netflix account. All of the 10 series that are on Netflix, I believe we're up at 20 now. I believe there are 20, so there's 10 that I haven't watched. But I honestly think there's something that's really like endearing about them, but more, I think it's like this thing, maybe it's part of a bigger perception on kind of thinking about sustainability in general, of like, we shouldn't be trying to do all these like doing things perfectly. And there's one thing that I really like about the Kardashians, which is that actually they are imperfect humans, but I love seeing where there are glimmers of their own humanity in different things that they do. And one of the examples recently, I know that they've got now the Kardashians Closet on, they have a website where they sell all their old designer gear for ridiculous amounts of money. But I think it's just, I don't know, there's something about them I just really like that's like, I kind of feel like I shouldn't do, but I do. And I think that's actually like, They're humans, they're flawed. I'm a human, I'm flawed. And like, I don't know, I think that we shouldn't maybe be so snobby with what we watch, and in their own way, they're quite cool.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. No, 100%. Like, I like to ask this question because I don't really think there should be guilt in what you watch. Kind of just, being like, oh yeah, I do enjoy watching this, even though there is a fair share of private jets in there. You know, like that's... completely fair. And then finally, what's a movie or a show you'd love to experience for the first time again?
Probably True Romance. It was one of my favourite go-to films for quite a long time. And I just think Alabama Worley's character is just also another amazing female heroine. So yeah, I think that's probably one that I would want to have seen for the first time again.
You've really taken on quite a beast. Let's say a 17-year-old you who was out there traveling, if she could see you now, how do you think she'd react?
Good question. I think I would be proud of myself, and I think I would also be quite surprised. Even literally a year ago, I definitely didn't expect to be in this type of work now, and I think in general in my 20s, I mean, again, when I was chatting earlier in the conversation about how did I get into film? And my whole early experiences of film was, it did feel very otherworldly. It's like, there aren't, you know, it's not like Dundee's the on the map for filmmaking, for productions happening in Dundee, and even in Scotland, even in the UK in some ways. Like, I didn't see this, that type of work to be something that I was actually ever going to be a part of. It just completely didn't, yeah. So it's like, I've already done more than what my kind of dreams were back in my teenage years, and I've achieved more through that than I expected to do probably even in a lifetime. So yeah, and maybe that speaks to what I was saying earlier about feeling like, well, I kind of have nothing to lose to give this new job everything that I've got at this moment in time, because it's like, I don't really have anything to lose, and I think we just need change to happen, we just need things to get done, and I'm just like, I'm too kind of like, okay, we need to do stuff. So I would think proud, but also surprised. Proud and surprised, I think.
Proud and surprised. No, that's good. I'm sure there are many, but is there a woman in the industry that inspires you who you'd like to give a shout out to?
So I would say in the Scottish industry specifically, I'd give a shout out to Libby Penman, who is a female documentary self-shooter for wildlife documentary films specifically. I actually know Libby originally from working with her on a drama. I think it was a BBC show called Trust Me. It's about doctors. So I knew her then, and we'd spoken about like interest in sustainability way back then. But she has since gone on to start doing her own documentaries, and I realized it was the first time I'd seen a woman making wildlife filmmaking, and maybe that's because I haven't been watching that much film and TV before coming into this job in this past year. But I think she's great, and I think the productions that she makes are good. And secondly, I would say another woman who's working in the space of environmental sustainability in film and TV, which is Roxy Erickson. And Roxy is an expert on, she helped, she was the initiation or the inspiration behind a collaboration of Creative Zero, that's a consultancy company that she runs with Film London. And they wrote the Fuel Report, which was all about different types of fuel use. So again, H-fuel, your battery alternatives, and opportunities for hydrogen use. And Roxy was one of our speakers at our Portable Renewable Power in Scotland workshop last week. And she is very good at what she does. And it's really amazing to see a woman excel in a space that's traditionally male dominated. So I've loved seeing her do that in that space specifically. So I would give a shout out to her work on that.
Amazing. And for people who want to know more about what you do, who want to keep up with you, where should they go? What do you want to plug and promote?
So I have currently got no social media on Facebook or Instagram.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. It has actually, I think I probably was addicted to both at one point, but I don't have either right now, and it's actually been quite amazing. So I don't have any personal social media to send people to. I do have LinkedIn if anybody wants to get in touch about work, but again, I'm kind of, haven't really been using that much either. So I would say actually sign up to the Beck2 Vision mailing list, and we do a sustainability newsletter once every couple months, which gives a roundup of all different things that's happening and that people can get involved with. We're going to be launching our sustainability coordinator training tomorrow, which is the first, as far as I'm aware, the first of its kind in the UK from public sector. So that's really exciting. And yeah, sign up to the Beck2 mailing list and hear more about the work that's happening in Scotland. It's kind of good, actually. Beck2 Vision are great, just to plug them in general. They're great for anybody wanting to work in the film industry in Scotland in general. So loads of great short courses, and all for free as well. Mostly via Skills Development Scotland, I think. Hopefully I got that right. So yeah, check them out anyway for all things filmmaking in Scotland, and specifically sustainability, the work of mine in sustainability specifically through them. So yes, check them out.
Fantastic. I'll make sure that they're linked down below. Thank you so much for coming on and giving a very human perspective to something that is extremely complex and sometimes very overwhelming. It's been really enlightening listening to you, and hopefully this will spark inspiration for other people listening and kind of open their eyes to something that is bubbling up, coming to the surface and needs to be faced with. Do you have any last words you'd like to say? I'll let you have the last ones.
Be honest with yourself. People in general, I think we need more honesty in the world, from all different levels, all different kinds of people, and especially when we're looking at, like you said, a massive topic like sustainability, and how much of a challenge that is, or is and is going to be across society, that we need more honest conversations with different kinds of people. So I think the starting point of that is people to be honest with themselves, to then be able to be honest with other people.
And welcome to our round table. Are we gonna sing a song?
We can.
Yeah, do you wanna start?
Welcome to our round table. It's January 16th. It's the new year, new round table. Oh my god, please cut that out forever.
Yeah, amazing round table, even though you'll actually be listening to this on the 18th of January. Happy round table. Happy round table? I don't know. Are we a happy round table, Lauren?
At the moment? Yeah, I think we are. We're happy.
We're a tired round table, but we're a happy round table. We are a round table. I'm at a table. You're not at a table. My table's not round. Round table is a state of mind.
Precisely.
As you know, I'm your host, Evita.
And I am the friend, Lauren.
Yes, she's a friend of us all. Anyway, so this has been another week in January of me committing to just watching movies. Just watching them, just not postponing it, not saying, oh, I need to watch that, and then continuing to browse Netflix for 30 minutes only to end up watching It's Always Sunny again, because that is my routine. But it's not long, no longer. Mm-mm, this is the year of decisiveness. So we're watching movies, and yesterday, Lauren and I, we watched a movie, didn't we, Lauren?
Yes, we did. We watched a movie indeed.
That is a fact. We watched The Menu from last year, directed by Mark Mylod. Mylod? 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 No. Mylod. M-Y-L-O-D. Mylod. Mylod? I don't. How would you say that?
Mylod.
Yeah, it was directed by him. And despite the fact that really the representation of women in lead roles behind the scenes aren't amazing, with only 4 of 10 producers being women, and the only female-led departments being art direction, set decoration, and costume design. Which is not untypical, and is thus quite disappointing to see, especially for a movie that is making a lot of statements about wealth and gender and all those things. First, Lauren, what was your initial reaction? What was your first reaction when we were watching this movie?
It was cutting. It was very quick, very witty, because obviously I had heard that it was more of an eat the rich message, so I was kind of waiting to see that around every turn, but everywhere it took me, it shocked me just because of how it was executed. It was just so sharp, you know, it was so good. It was, it just, it honestly had me speechless, like, at the end. I mean, you know, we were there.
Oh, yeah, we were just there, like, oh. We let the credits roll to the full end before we said a word, you know? It was like that.
Yeah, they got to the Georgia thing where it was, like, produced in Georgia, and I never let movies get that far where it says it was filmed, like...
It needed, like, the breath afterwards. Yeah, so without going into too many spoilers, because obviously this movie, especially in the UK, is still in a very limited release. So I'm not going to really get into how it ends and things like that. Personally, I had no idea what this movie was about. I knew it was about wealth and capitalism and such. I knew that that was the theme and that it had to do with a restaurant, but that was the end of it because I don't read bios or watch trailers anymore. So I was just there sitting and letting it take me in. It just felt like it was choking you the entire time. No, I very much enjoyed it, but I think what was interesting is obviously you could see it very straightforwardly as a movie about rich people and kind of, you know, what they're willing to spend their money on. But I think this is like an allegory for so many things, especially when it comes to passionate endeavors, so things in the arts specifically. To kind of actually give a summary of the menu, because we should probably do that for people who don't know, for people who are like me, but who also haven't watched the movie and who are also listening to this for some reason, God knows why. This film focuses on a young couple who visits an exclusive destination restaurant on a remote island where the acclaimed chef has prepared a lavish tasting menu, along with some shocking surprises. So this is very much about, I think, how we fall out of love with our passions and how, yeah, no, I think our chef, played by Ralph Fiennes?
Beans.
By good old Valdi, he, you know, he's this incredibly acclaimed chef who makes very prestige courses and dishes, and it is not about eating, it is about tasting and all of that. But he started out flipping burgers, he started out making cheeseburgers, as is often when you know you reached the creme de la creme, is when you are creating these incredibly lavish experiences where you're basically being served no food at all, like on a plate, right? And it goes to a point where I think it is so prestigious and so sophisticated that the people who are enjoying this and who are spending thousands on enjoying these 8-meal courses at a certain point also have to trick themselves into believing that this is worth it and that this is actually the value that they've paid for, and that it just is so, that it's just like the highest level. And it's basically all just incredibly pretentious, right? Like, it's incredibly pretentious to pay God knows how much for, you know, 9 drops of different sauces, right? Like, that is incredibly pretentious. And again, you do fool yourself into then believing you have to, right? You have to be like, oh, this is really good, right? You can't just sit there and be like, you know, you have to in order to make yourself feel better about the choices you've made as well. In order to make yourself feel better about the choices you made in ordering it or being served it, but also to make you feel like you are the best of the best because you are enjoying the best of the best. And I think that just translate, a lot into film as well, and how, especially right now, when we are in this award season, which is known for inspiring movies to be created solely to be awarded prizes, not to be enjoyed by audiences, but to win Golden Globes, Oscars, BAFTAs, all of that. And a lot of these movies are empty, I think. A lot of these movies are just Oscar bait, you know? They are fluff that are designed to make you feel sophisticated and make you feel superior and incredibly intellectual for saying that it's like the best movie ever, when really it's not. And it's just, it's empty. And it feels sometimes in these film circles like people will pick a movie and talk about it and like human centipede it to a point where it's just like, this is not what you think it is. But it makes you feel good, right? To make you feel superior in a way. Intellectually, culturally, all those things, and make you feel like you understand the deeper meaning of things when there sometimes isn't a deeper meaning. I thought that was interesting. And then also kind of the part of our chef's journey, also falling out of love with food and with serving people food and with seeing people enjoy the food as well, because I think he got to a point where he realized that it's all just like a self-created simulation, right? Where he's making pretentious food for pretentious people to pretend to enjoy, and for him to pretend. Yeah, it's just like, it's this circle that is created in these like high societies. So I thought that was interesting.
Definitely. Very good analysis on it, I think.
Yeah, and just, yeah, also kind of what happens to a lot of filmmakers, where you start out flipping burgers, you start out doing the work on sets, and you start to fall in love with filmmaking as a craft, and with the feeling it emulates, and you strive to then create it and to be the god of it, like how create your own like worlds, right? In the same way that chefs create ecosystems and worship them. You know, I think that's natural to strive for, but in the end, a lot of people who do go to that point, because of the way the industry works, you stop making movies because you, and like, obviously I'm not saying this is how everybody feels, but I think a lot of people in the film industry and in other artistic endeavors feel like when you get to a certain level, and you've like accomplished it, you've made it, what you're making isn't for you anymore. It's for, you know, it's for executive producers, and it's for awards, and it's for critics, and it's not for your family, it's not for the people you love or communities you love. It is not for the story necessarily, even. At a certain point, the story becomes a void as well, because you have to adapt it and adjust it so much to the expectations, and to the kind of like high society, like ultra far intellectual analysis of movies, which people might argue I'm doing right at this moment. you know, yeah, we're just, I think a lot of filmmakers kind of end up in a spot where they fall out of love with film. So, yeah. I think that was very interesting, and kind of and in a twisted way, it was inspiring, to let us keep enjoying cheeseburgers, you know? I said that as somebody who doesn't eat meat, but, you know, to appreciate and associate our love for art and passion more with the feelings that go into it rather than the deeper meaning, you know?
It becomes vague. It's got no substance to it. It's, you know, surface level.
Yeah. And things that, you know, again, we've been talking a lot about movies that are just like nostalgic movies that make us feel warm and that we have positive associations with, the movies that are guilty pleasures and that we know aren't amazing quality, but the way we consumed them also probably as children and in a much more innocent way, it's a happy feeling and a feeling a lot of people want to return to. Like, a lot of people am tired of this kind of film bro mentality where everything are the exact, like, everything is Tarantino, everything is Kubrick, and that is like the best that film can come up with, and anything that isn't isn't cinema or whatever. But like, art is what we feel when we see it, right? It's not something that I think can be judged by one person or like deemed by one person. Like, I was talking I'm like looking into graffiti at the moment in my course, and it's like an interesting thing because it's most of the time it's a crime, it's illegal. And then a lot of the time it's also art. But like, some people think graffiti is ugly and then they don't think it's art. And then, so it's not art to them, right? But that doesn't mean it's not art to other people or to the artist. Or the artist might not even think of it as art, but somebody else seeing it might find the emotion it evokes to be art. So yes, it's up to the eye of the beholder.
But, I mean, compared to what I have to say, which is not much, frankly, I think that, I don't know, you pretty much said everything that needs to be said about the movie and the message of, you know, falling out of love with one's passion. But I think that, like, the art of, cooking like that, of like, you know, really the really fancy kind, the really expensive kind, I think it's super stupid. Like, I just think it's dumb. I don't think that there's a lot to it. I think that food shouldn't be that expensive. I think it should be edible. And I understand how it's an art of some sort. Like, I think, like, when you go to those places, you don't go to eat, you go to taste, which is what he legitimately talks about. But I think that, you know, the chef in the film became so obsessed with the flavor or perfecting something to eat that eventually it just became inedible because it was, you know, it just became like a bunch of weird flavors, like the ice that, like the ocean water ice that he puts on top of that fleshy thing or whatever it was, like, so it melts and it... That's just so exaggerated, I think, to me. And that can be applied to, like, art as well, like, physical art, you know? Like, sometimes, like NFTs, you know? Like, that's very stupid, you know? But it's considered art of some sort. And I think, like, minimalism, I think, is a joke as an art. Sorry, you guys are learning. I hate minimalism. But I think it's dumb. Like, why is a painting of, like, a line going for, like, a gazillion... dollars? It's just like, it's so pointless to me. And obviously, like, it is art to someone else and to the artist, but I think that it's just like rich people pretending to be cultured about a line
exactly yeah
on a piece of
to enjoy things
exactly just so they it seems good and they'll pay for it. And it's like, why are you doing that? You know, no one cares. And I think, you know, when it comes to film as well, it can just become like, it can just become a fleshy thing with ocean water ice on it, you know? It's not very good.
But it looks nice.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's what, like, I've been thinking a lot about big, starry ensemble casts in films recently. It looks good because it's got Robert De Niro and Margot Robbie in it. But is it going to look good? Is it going to be a good movie? Am I going to think about it? Did I even watch it? No, probably not. Like, it's just, sometimes it's just kind of...
The House of Gucci trauma is, like...
I know. It's just, like...
And it loses itself, you know? Like, I think that's what happened to Euphoria, where I think it became... so self-important in a way. And I do think, like, there's some things I enjoyed in season two and that, but I think it became too self-important, and the good qualities of season one was amplified to a point where it didn't make sense and it didn't do anything, and it was just like beautiful imagery, but it wasn't powerful. Yeah. And like, also, like, again, as we're talking about all these movies that are like kind of void and empty, and we watch them, we're like, oh my god, that was amazing, that was, blah blah blah. But do we remember them in 2 years? No, we don't. Like The Dishes, right? Like, that he served, that he also, again, and the people who work on these movies do put a lot of effort into them. Not saying that they don't necessarily care, not at all. Like, that's, I don't know them, right? And some people surely care, and it must be annoying to then see people misinterpret it or whatever. But like, in the movie, you know, he asks them, do you remember what you ate last time you were here? And they don't, right? They don't remember. But they sure probably talked about it with their friends forever. And they came back, you know, because they loved the feeling and what they, how it made them feel. Not like in a passion way, but in like a status way. And that was the menu. And we have 1 minute remaining here. Anything else?
Nope. It was an excellent movie. It was very well executed, I think. And the cast was amazing. Mm-hmm. Everyone is very talented. They did a great job of delivering everything that needed to be. Yes. They served, literally, if you will. Like.
So, yeah, that was it. Love you.
Love you.
Love you. Love you. You guys can't hear what I'm pointing to, but I pointed to you, Lauren, and then I pointed to my phone. Love you all. And keep enjoying the things that you enjoy guilt-free.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Making It Women in Film, a podcast produced by Bonnie and Brawl and LS Films. If you want to support this podcast, you can do so by subscribing to us wherever you're listening and leave a review or a rating. It'll only take you a few clicks, but it'll mean the world to us. You can also check out our website, womeninfilm.co.uk, follow us on LinkedIn and Instagram at Making Women in Film, and feel free to shoot us an email at makingwomeninfilm@gmail.com if you have any questions or inquiries or anything at all, and we'll try to get back to you. All right, I guess I'll just see you next week. Bye.